from bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yeah, thanks as always, Ollie. Welcome to Thursday's programme. Bit of a mixed bag weather-wise. I like to tell you about the weather, you know. We've had rain, we've had it all here. But it's brightened up. It is May 2nd, 2019. This is your Richie Allen Show. I love doing it. Love being here. Got a good one for you today.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
At least I think so anyway. All right, you can tweet the program. Tweet me.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I'll be joined later this hour by an old friend of mine, Mark Windows from Windows on the World. Really, really, really top researcher is Mark, and I'm looking forward to speaking with him. He's been doing some really interesting research into the Extinction Rebellion group and all the other issues around that, and I think we'll get into that with him and other things as well. Mark will be with me for the best part of an hour, and he joins me in around about 25-30 minutes time. Mark Windows on the programme. Before that, there are a few things of interest in the news, or there are a few things that I found interesting anyway. I've got a news roundup for you. You can participate, of course, just by tweeting the programme as you ordinarily do. So please do that. Hi to Martin in Spain, who's listening with Linda, with Swifty and Charlie. How you doing? They believe that they are being sprayed or chemtrailed in Spain. They're on the east coast, Costa Blanca, I believe, northeast of Spain. Thanks for the tweet, Martin. Nice to hear from you. Matthew Phillips as well, Liz Jones. Yeah, get rid of the music. Thanks for tweeting the programme so early. You're in early. Where am I going to start today? First of all, I just want to say thanks again to Sharon Gale for coming on the programme last night and catching up with us a year after she first spoke to us. And I noticed today, or at least I was told by my YouTube helping friend, that a lot of people were accessing the first conversation that we had last year. She's a remarkable woman, which is a bit of an understatement, and I want to reiterate every single word of her story as told by her is absolutely true. There isn't any conjecture, as I said last night. It isn't one side of the story. It isn't the story as she sees it. It is absolutely true. And as a presenter, I'm going to say again, nobody has ever come to me in my career quite like her with a bag full of evidence to say, my child was unlawfully killed, one way or another. And the state and the medical authorities in this country have conspired to cover it up. And not only that, but they've been retaliating against me and my family ever since. It's all true, every bloody word of it. She's a great lady, and she'll come back on again in the near future, Sharon Gale. I know a lot of you have been contacting her on Facebook. She has a Facebook page, Sharon Gale. There's only one Sharon. It's S-H-A-R-O-N, not double R. If you put Sharon Gale in, you'll find her very quickly. And I believe I'm not on Facebook anymore. She's very accommodating with people. Hi to Murray as well. Let's start off with something a bit crazy, shall we? Is that irony? Is that irony, by any chance, me saying let's start off with something crazy? Sure, it's all crazy. Wait for it. A US cruise ship has been placed in quarantine by the Caribbean island of St. Lucia after a case of measles was reported on board. This according to the island's chief medical officer.
What kind of fuckery is this?
There are people on a cruise ship in St. Lucia, and they are still there, and they are not being allowed to leave because somebody on the ship has measles. It's not a joke. The island's chief medical officer is a woman called Dr. Merlene Fredericks James. Dr. Merlene Fredericks James. And she said, there's a confirmed case of measles on board, and I thought it was prudent that we quarantine the ship. Nobody on board the ship has been allowed to leave. Yeah. The actor Gary Busey is on board, and he thinks the measles outbreak started in the kitchen.
He's a cook, plain and simple.
This is not the work of a cook.
He came on board with the captain. I know his routine, front and back.
Yeah, it could be the cook. The ship is reportedly called the Free Winds. And even more bizarrely, it's said to be owned and operated by the Church of Scientology. Dr. James said in a video statement posted on YouTube, the ministry learned of the confirmed measles case from two reputable sources. Imagine it turns out that the person has had an allergic reaction to the chowder or something. I'd love to see the island. You're not going anywhere. This ship is in quarantine. And would you believe this? This is incredible. I've had a message on Twitter from Vina James or Vina Janus, JP Maxwell. It could be JP in Manchester, is it? Is it JP? He changes his Twitter name all the time. He's a slippery sod, is JP. Apparently, in Orange County, California, people who went to see a midnight screening of Avengers Endgame have been warned that they might have contracted measles from an infected audience member. And this is in the Huffington Post, apparently, today. So people who went to see the film in a certain theatre have now been contacted by the theatre and the health authorities to say you might have the measles because we think somebody in the cinema had the measles. This is just madness, you know. Isn't it? Hi to Julian David Kelly, who's listening live for the first time. Has been listening on YouTube and Spotify, listening live for the first time. How you doing, Julian? Thanks for listening, my friend, and thanks so much for the tweet today. Imagine being on that ship in the Caribbean. Imagine the thousands that you've outlaid to tour the Caribbean on a ship. You probably hummed the theme from the Love Boat for weeks before you embarked. You were going around thinking about Julie, our cruise director. The Love Boat. You had it all in your head if it was your first cruise. And now you're being told you're stuck on the bastard thing because somebody has the measles. Let's talk about something else. The co-founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, his extradition hearing began today at Westminster Magistrates Court. He appeared by video link and he has told the court today is that he doesn't consent to being extradited to America over charges related to leaking government secrets. Now, you know, yesterday he was sentenced to 50 weeks in jail for breaching the Bail Act following his arrest last month. Of course, you'll remember this. A lot of people have said, and I agree with them, the 50-week sentence is excessive, very excessive. And a lot of people think this is to give the US authorities time to get their way. Because this extradition hearing could take months, by the way. So it suits them that he's been sentenced to 50 weeks. This stinks to high heaven, of course. The extradition process will take many months, says the BBC, as I just said. Assange said, I do not wish to surrender myself for extradition for doing journalism that has won many awards and protected many people. He's not a journalist. This makes me laugh. I'm very... How do I describe how I feel about Assange? It's wrong that he's been locked up. It's wrong that he should be extradited to the United States. That's wrong because the information is in the public interest. But he's not a journalist. He's a hacker. And he was given some information and he put it online. Right. Stop calling yourself a journalist. You know this is a real bugbear with me. But I'm not going to get into it too much today. I don't agree with him being locked up. If there's any evidence that he committed any sexual assault against anybody in Sweden, dubious this. If there is any, present it. Show it. And put him on trial and be done with it. I think the sexual allegation stuff is related to the desire of the United States to get him over there. And that's not to say that I don't have sympathy with women or men who have been sexually assaulted either. Right. A lot of supporters of Assange outside the court demanding his freedom. It's going to run for months, right? Let's talk about climate change. Climate change. The UK should lead the global fight against climate change. And the UK should cut greenhouse gases to nearly zero by 2050, which is 30 years from now, more or less, 31 years. Who's saying this? Well, the Committee on Climate Change, the CCC. The CCC maintains that we can cut greenhouse gases to zero by 2050 at no added cost from previous estimates. Its report says that if other countries follow the UK's lead, there is a 50-50 chance of staying below the recommended 1.5 degree temperature rise by 2100. This 1.5 degree centigrade rise is considered the threshold for dangerous climate change. Fucking bullshit, but we've said that 1,000 times before. Some say, according to the BBC, that the proposed 2050 target for near zero emissions is too soft, but others say the goal could damage the UK's economy. Well, it's going to damage your economy, and it's going to damage my economy, our personal finances, no doubt about that. So the CCC, which is allegedly independent and advises government on climate change, said it would not be able to hit net zero emissions any sooner than 2050, but it is a significant goal. Wait for this. The cost of the new proposal is tens of billions of pounds a year and may reach to 1 to 2% of national wealth as measured by GDP each year by 2050. Tens of billions of pounds of years. Alarm bells are ringing. How do you think they're going to pay for that? Who are they going to come to collect that money from? Well, you daft bastard. And me, who else? It's going to cost tens of billions. The alarm bells are ringing. They want to eliminate petrol and diesel cars by 2030. Yep. That's 11 years from now. I had to do the subtraction and the addition on my fingers. Do you ever find yourself doing that? I do it on my fingers. Cracks up the future, Mrs. Allen. 11 years from now, they want diesel and petrol cars gone. I've got a 6-year-old diesel Renault Megane. I'll probably still have it in 11 years. They'll have to fucking pry my cold, dead hands from the steering wheel. I'm not giving it up. I love that old hunk of junk. And it's not killing the planet. So there's a few controversial recommendations. One of the things they want to do is they want to turn down the home thermostat to 19 degrees centigrade in winter. They want this to be made the law. I'm not kidding you. This isn't conspiracy theory. This isn't, they're turning the bloody frogs gay. This is, we want it to be made law that the home thermostat must be 19 degrees centigrade in winter and no more. So, fuck the old people then. I'm freezing, says old Vera. Fuck off and die, bitch. You're only holding back the young anyhow, as we've heard in recent weeks. They also want to interfere with the number of flights we take. The report is calling for massive taxation for every second, third and fourth flight you might take every year. Lovely. Now, there's never been a greater collection of lunatics under one umbrella than Greenpeace. What a bunch of nutters. Oh, how I cheered when Harry Stamper hit golf balls at the scruffy bollockses in Armageddon. Got a few odd looks in the cinema when I was cheering that. Greenpeace was out in force on UK television today. Here's Rebecca Newsome, head of politics at Greenpeace. Rebecca was asked, do you think we can get zero carbon emissions by 2050? What do you think, you mad box of frogs? What do you think?
It totally is. I think we, of course, it is a big challenge. The scale of the transition that we need to see across the whole of our society is enormous. But we have seen dramatic and significant advances in recent years with things like offshore wind, where the technology has been proven and the price has dropped. So with the right kind of government leadership and vision, we can make this goal. And frankly, this is a survival issue, so there isn't another alternative.
You say it's feasible, but there are challenges ahead. How painful is it?
How painful is it going to be? Well, for you and me, it's going to be excruciatingly painful because we're going to have, even Orwell couldn't have imagined it. You're going to have the state looking into your fridge, looking into your oven, looking into your house, 24 hours a day telling you you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't wash clothes today, you can't empty your bins today, you can't eat this meat today, you can't fly today. This is where it's going. This is not a joke. How painful is it? Well, Greenpeace lunatic Rebecca Newsom was asked about aviation and diet and cars and stuff like that.
Well, aviation is definitely one area where it currently the solutions to make it more sustainable are much less readily available and less developed. So that means that to tackle that sector, we do need to limit how much we're flying. And so one way of doing that in a way that is fair for people is an idea that we've got called the frequent flyer levy. So that means every family in the UK would get one completely tax-free return flight a year. So families can go on their annual holiday abroad. But for people who fly much more than that, for every tax after that, every flight after that, the tax increases. So the people who fly the most take the most responsibility. And that is also a way to limit demand.
You can fly once a year, and after that, we'll tax the absolute bejesus out of you and we'll make it basically unaffordable for the vast majority of people on the planet. I'm not misrepresenting what she said. That's exactly what she said. We'll give you one tax-free flight, and after that, increasing taxation on the price of the travel, making it basically untenable for most people to fly thereafter.
Demand.
So it's going to get more expensive to fly is one way of dealing with that. What about more lifestyle issues like our diets, like the way in which we run our houses?
What about the way we eat and the way we run our houses, Rebecca Newsom?
Well, absolutely. So we do need to cut down on how much meat and dairy we're eating. So Greenpeace is supporting an 80% reduction in meat consumption, which is backed up by
80%. Health experts.
This is a batshit crazy fucking psychopath talking here. 80%, yeah.
But
80%
is... Yeah. 80%. Yeah. Between now and 2050, and that's supported by scientists, climate scientists, and also health professionals, as being something that's not only good for our health but also vital for the climate emergency. So we do need to see that change, and that's something that every individual on a personal level does need to start taking responsibility for.
Yeah, we need to start taking responsibility for it just in time. Start taking responsibility for it now, because if you don't, we're coming to tell you what to do. You see, every film you saw in the 1980s and 1990s, every science fiction film that predicted a horrible dystopian future with a draconian, all-oppressing, completely horrifying government, with a jackboot on the necks of the collective population, none of those films actually come close to where this is all going to end up. They couldn't imagine in their wildest dreams in the 80s and 90s where we were actually going to go with all of this. This is, it's madness. And there's no opposition to it. What you've got is a cheerleading media. Cheerleading it. Presenters going along with it. Softball questions like 80%? Meat reduction? Really? Really? And then no follow-up questions on that. Crazy stuff. We'll get into some of this with Mark Windows shortly. Now, according to the BBC, according to the BBC, a woman was shot dead and dozens injured in Caracas yesterday, in clashes between opposition supporters and pro-government forces. Hilarious, the BBC uses terms like opposition supporters and pro-government forces. The language is amazing, isn't it? Nicolas Maduro is the rightfully elected president of Venezuela, and the police and the army are rightfully loyal to the government, because that's who they should be loyal to. That's who gives them their authority to act. If a woman was killed, it's a terrible thing. Tear gas and water cannons were used to disperse people. Juan Guaido, the Washington-backed puppet who declared himself the rightful president, of course, back in January, said those responsible for the death of the 27-year-old woman would be found. This is crazy stuff. Blah, 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 blah. Donald Trump's national security advisor, the psychopath John I Am the Walrus Bolton, told a bunch of reporters in D.C. that the U.S. isn't engaged in a coup against Venezuela. Two reporters fainted from laughing and had to be given oxygen.
Clearly not a coup. We recognize Juan Guaido as the legitimate interim president of Venezuela. And just as it's not a coup when the president of the United States gives an order to the Department of Defense, it's not a coup for Juan Guaido to try and take command of the Venezuelan military.
I'd love to have 30 seconds in a room with Bolton. People normally say 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 30 seconds is enough for me to get a hold of Bolton. Yeah, I'm unshackling myself. I'm unburdening myself from my normal adherence to change by peaceful means only. I think I'd make an exception for Bolton. Sky News is a propaganda machine. No news there, nothing new there. All week long, loads of academics have come on, brought out from stage right to say that Maduro is a madman and has destroyed the economy and the country. The latest in the hit parade today was a guy called Tom Long from Warwick University. I'm not going to play it. I won't subject you to it because you've heard it all before. Never-ending procession of academics with apparently expertise in Latin American politics telling you Maduro's a madman, he's brutal, he's a dictator, his policies have destroyed the country. The mainstream media has basically given up on even pretending to be objective. The party line is Venezuela, run by a madman, he has to go. Right. Still maddens me, even though we know anyway. But anyway, here's a very interesting bit of news. A new report emerged yesterday by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and it was co-authored by the economists Jeffrey Sachs and Mark Weisbrot. The report claims that 40,000 Venezuelans have died in the country since 2017 as a direct result of US sanctions. This is the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The economists Jeffrey Sachs and Mark Weisbrot, they say in 2 years 40,000 Venezuelans at least have died because of sanctions imposed on the country by the US. Now Jeffrey Sachs, one of the authors, he's a leading economist and he is director for the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. He was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman last night. Not a single newspaper in the UK, not a single radio or television channel has mentioned this report and its finding. No surprise there, of course. Here's Jeffrey Sachs explaining to Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! How the United States has brought the country of Venezuela to the situation it's in and caused the deaths of 40,000 people. This clip is 2.5 minutes long. Listen very carefully to it.
It's a complete economic collapse, a catastrophe in Venezuela. There was a crisis for sure before Trump came to office. But the idea of the Trump administration from the start has been to overthrow Maduro. That's not a hypothesis. So Trump was very explicit in discussions with presidents of Latin America, where he asked them, why shouldn't the U.S. just invade? He said that already in 2017. So the idea of the Trump administration has been to overthrow Maduro from the start. Well, the Latin leader said, no, no, that's not a good idea. We don't want military action. So the U.S. government has been trying to strangle the Venezuelan economy. It started with sanctions in 2017 that prevented essentially the country from accessing international capital markets and the oil company from restructuring its loans. That put Venezuela into a hyperinflation. That was the utter collapse. Oil earnings plummeted. The earnings that are used to buy food and medicine collapsed. That's when the social humanitarian crisis went spiraling out of control. And then in this year, is with this idea, very naive, very stupid in my view, that there would be this self-proclaimed president, which was all choreographed with the United States very, very closely, another round of even tighter sanctions, essentially confiscating the earnings and the assets of the Venezuelan government took place. Now Venezuela is in complete, utter catastrophe. A lot of it brought on by the United States deliberately creating massive, massive suffering.
You listening to that? You are? You've gotten all of this so far, right? This guy's explaining scientifically and forensically how the sanctions levied on the country have brought it to its knees, not the policies of the president.
Massive suffering. We know there's hunger. We know there's an incredible shortage of medical supplies. We can only imagine, because we won't know really until the dust settles and careful studies are done, how much excess mortality there is. But surely in a context like this, this is a catastrophe largely created by the U.S. because, as was said earlier, this is an all-or-nothing strategy. What the U.S., what Trump just doesn't understand, and what Bolton, of all, of course, never agrees to, is the idea of negotiations. This is an attempt at an overthrow. It's very crude. It's not working. And it's very cruel because it's punishing 30 million people.
This is a detailed report carried out by this guy Sachs, the economist, and his co-author, Weisbrot, the Center for Economic and Policy Research. It is unimpeachable. It's a long report. It's online. Google Center for Economic and Policy Research. You'll get the entire report. Not a single media organization in the UK has given it a mention today, as they roll out one academic after another to say it's all the madman Maduro. Dan Kovalik is a noted human rights lawyer. He says we have been here time and time again with the U.S. and coups.
The U.S. supports coup d'etats all the time. This is another example of that. Juan Guaido has no power under the Constitution of Venezuela. The fact the U.S. recognizes him is of no import. The U.S. recognizes him because he has already agreed to privatize Venezuela's oil in the interest of U.S. companies. That's why the U.S. recognizes him, and that does not make him legitimate. This is an unfolding coup that the U.S. wants to push forward. And we have to remember, by the way, the U.S. supported the coup in 2002 against Hugo Chavez and were reluctant to call it a coup back then. The fact that the U.S. wants to use semantics to cover up what it's doing doesn't change the fact that this is a coup.
It's a coup. It's 11:30. Mark Windows will join me in a couple of minutes' time. Just before that, there's time even for one more story. This was all over the news yesterday, but it's kind of stretched into today. There's a lot of coverage of this. A primary school down south plans... it's not down south. It's up north. It's in Leeds. Plans to slaughter pigs raised on its farm to teach pupils about the food chain. Did you hear this? Came up yesterday, as I said, getting loads of coverage. Children as young as 4 at Farsley Farfield Primary in Leeds have been helping to feed the Gloucester Old Spot pigs at the mini farm, which has vegetable patches and hens. The head teacher, Peter Harris, believes the decision to slaughter the pigs will make the young pupils more knowledgeable and sensitive to animal welfare. Children as young as 4. Wow. They're seeing the lovely little piglets. They're spending time with them. They're raising them. And then they will be slaughtered. And I don't know if the children will eat them or they will make products out of them. I have no idea. But there's a lot of controversy about this. The head teacher's a vegetarian, said on the school's blog, through keeping the pigs, the children will learn more about the provenance of their food and issues around animal welfare. I think we are raising awareness of the meat industry and sustainability. The pigs will live twice as long as they ordinarily would, and they will enjoy outdoor life with plenty of opportunity to root around. The welfare standards are higher than most pigs will be exposed to. I don't think we're desensitizing the children. I suggest our children will be more knowledgeable and sensitive to animal welfare than most of their peers. 4-year-olds, though. Is it a bit early to be introducing 4-year-olds to the notion of slaughtering animals? Maybe it isn't. I don't know. I think it could be very traumatic for them. Here's Theodora Iona from PETA UK speaking to RT.
The problem is that this is a Disney version of farming. The truth is that the vast majority of animals killed for our meat are factory farmed. They are kept in indoors in crowded, filthy sheds, and the only time they see sunlight or they smell fresh air is when they're loaded onto trucks and sent to the slaughterhouse. That is the reality of farming. And if the school was really interested in teaching children about where meat comes from, then they would take them to the slaughterhouse.
Mm. Not sure about children in slaughterhouses. I'm not going to be a hypocrite here. I do eat meat. I know there are members of this audience who don't. There are vegetarians amongst the audience. They're also vegans. I have great respect for people's personal choices. We do the best we can to source our meat from, you know, you look for packaging, you look for responsible sources of meat. She mentioned Disney there. I've often thought we were screwing with the minds of children by making cartoon animals in films for children, animals that talk and animals that have personalities. I've often wondered, what does that do to the minds of children? I don't know. What do I know about it? This is the Richie Allen Show for Thursday.
You made a fool of me.
Mark Windows is standing by and will join the programme in a couple of minutes. This is your Richie Allen Show, live on Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. Nothing like it, Europe's most listened to independent radio show, windowsontheworld.net. Mark Windows joins us after this. Right, ELO and Evil Woman went to see Jeff at the arena last year. Fantastic stuff. Loads of tweets already. Just before we say hi to Mark and welcome him back to the programme, La Antenna tweets, I wonder if they'll do cashback incentives for people who don't fly. I haven't flown in 24 years, he says. I'm looking forward to a nice green lump sum. Loads of tweets. Charlotte, Cartoon Drunk is tweeting. Hubertez is tweeting. Lots of people tweeting there. Check it out on twitter.com. It's Richie Allen Show, all one word. My guest today, no stranger to this programme, old friend of mine, love the man, terrific researcher, very, very good researcher. There are not many of them around. Check out Windows on the World on YouTube if you haven't before. Treasure trove of excellent programmes on matters domestic and geopolitical. He has an array of brilliant guests, often Piers Corbyn, great friend of his, and many more guests besides. Check it out if you haven't checked it out before. Let's welcome him back. He's going to stay with me for the best part of an hour, and we'll get through lots, I think. Mark Windows, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine, Richie.
Good to have you on. You're going to be talking in these parts and other parts around the country, and we'll talk about those events and what you're going to be talking about, where you're going to be. We'll do all that in the course of the next hour. You've done some terrific work on the Green Movement and Extinction Rebellion. Congratulations. Done a lot of work there, and you've educated me and many others as to who these people are. I think on the face of it, on the ground, I don't want to use the word yuppie, but the middle class, maybe more wealthy classes that are there dancing around on skateboards, these people are not evil. They might be wrong, but they're not evil. But the group itself and its origins, well, fairly sinister, brilliant work made, and it continues the work on Extinction Rebellion.
Oh, definitely, Richie. The thing is about these kind of groups and protests that seem to come out of nowhere is obviously they don't come out of nowhere. And a lot of people were actually saying, this is amazing, this movement. It just came out, sprang up overnight like a mushroom. Well, newsflash, you know, it didn't. I mean, a lot of this stuff is planned in the background for ages. This is another template organization, another template protest group on the back of other template protest groups such as Occupy. And all it's actually linked in to a lot of NGOs and globalism, basically. And of course, the IMF and World Bank. This is where it all goes back to. And of course, all is they're actually really doing is implementing the agenda of the United Nations. That's in their manifesto.
It's in the manifesto, isn't it? What about the... You mentioned they come out of nowhere. It's a really good point you're making there, because, you know, you and I, we spend a lot of our time reading the newspapers. We don't like it, but we do. We watch not only did we watch the news programs, but we watched the documentary programs and we watched the feature programs, Panorama and all the rest of it. And all of a sudden, Greta Thunberg, 16 years of age, articulate young woman with Asperger's, and here she is meeting the Pope, meeting world leaders, and she's got a message about climate change, and damn it, we better listen to it. You've gleaned some very interesting information about her, not only her background, but those around her, and how she's managing to, I don't know, bend the ear, if you want to use that term, of some of the world's most prominent politicians. Greta Thunberg, Mark.
Well, yes, the Greta Thunberg phenomenon actually came out of a PR company called We Don't Have Time, which her parents were involved with. And this fellow called Irma Rinsog, and basically he's a social engineer. And he believes that PR can be used in a way of sort of form of magic, really, to hypnotize people. If you look into these people, it's all about social engineering. And of course, she didn't come out of nowhere. And what's rather unfortunate is this girl's been terribly used because she's got Asperger's and selective mutism. And she's been basically programmed into this idea of an apocalypse through climate change. And of course, she's actually probably traumatized by it, in my opinion. And the parents are pushing her. The parents were in show business. The whole thing's a big PR campaign. And right now, I've just heard that she's presently in Sweden protesting against the far right. And we all know what that means, in effect. The far right came out of MI5. Mark Rowley, just before he resigned, head of MI5, said the new threat is from the far right, meaning, of course, people who vote Brexit. And we know all about the background of that, how they try to demonize people who voted Brexit. And when you look at this stuff, it all ties together. It all ties together into a controlled narrative of public opinion. Anything outside that narrative is to be demonized. And that's what all this is about, really.
Yeah, it's really good stuff, Mark. You're explaining it in a way that people listening to this program for the first time, it's giving them maybe a moment of pause and giving them another side of it. Nice of you to say that Greta Thunberg is a young girl with a condition and is not the enemy. She's not somebody to be spat at and screamed at and abused, and that she's being used. It's very effective. Before we I was going to ask you to explain a kind of a for dummies explanation of social engineering, because you've got a big old brain on you and we use these terms a lot. And I do, I do get contacts from various people from time to time. They say, Richard, you bandy around these terms, social engineering. We might talk about that in a second if you want to talk about that. But on this agenda, and before we can talk about the far right as well and how things like how it's been weaponized, let's talk about the fear, because it is. When you look around social media, it's very apparent that it's working, that younger people, and I've been very critical of younger people, I get stuck into them, often tongue-in-cheek, I'm not really mean-spirited, but I laugh at their perceived kind of narcissism and snowflakery, for want of a better word. But they genuinely are terrified, Mark. And this is the killer, you see. They're not liars. They're not bad people. They have genuinely been hoodwinked into believing that in 25 or 30 or 40 years, the planet is going to be uninhabitable and that we won't be able to breathe. They really do believe it, don't they?
Well, yes. And this all came out of think tanks like the Club of Rome, who announced that climate change would be used to basically frighten the public into believing that they were a blight on the planet. And that has been ongoing ever since. A lot of the early environmental movement was hijacked. For instance, groups like Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace, they were hijacked. And there's a whole network of NGOs involved in this. And what it is, in actual fact, obviously the UN have created a kind of apocalyptic scenario. Now, that apocalyptic scenario has never, ever actually emerged. And they've been talking about this for a very long time. You can go back to UN documents from the last 20, 30 years, and they've been announcing an apocalypse. Now, that apocalypse has something in common with the UN papers, the AR5 document, the SR15 document, which Extinction Rebellion have based their manifesto but seem to know nothing about. which is quite interesting, because I've talked to some of the people in Extinction Rebellion, and I say, but you're basing your whole premise on the SR-15. They look at you blankly.
They don't know. They don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
As though you're coming out with some kind of secret code, you know. Yeah. But this was all announced, and it's all a public record that they believe it. But the thing is about it, when you look into the predictions of the UN and what it's about and who's behind it, the people who are involved in all this social engineering and getting everyone on board with climate change know that it's not going to happen. And that's the thing about it. In our talks, we explain all that. I have all of the quotes from people within the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the lobbying body for the UN to bring in this basically climate catastrophobia.
And they're not even they're not even scientists, Mark. So they're not. The IPCC is basically, well, there are some scientists, but it's mostly lobbyists and politicians, basically.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't know this. So they'll say things like 97% of scientists agree, as though it's actual fact, when of course it isn't fact. And that's not even a true statement. It's a deceptive statement. And what you have to look at when you take this stuff apart is what's behind it.
Yeah.
We have basically mantras that are put into the public, like diversity, vibrant communities, sustainable development. Now, all of these things mean nothing to most people. They don't they can mean anything that they want them to mean. And what we have to remember here is that groups like Extinction Rebellion and Gail Bradbrook, who started Extinction Rebellion, one of the founders, her background is basically social engineering, to get back to your point, because she knows and she's been trained to basically call her a change agent, to make it simple, in that what she's doing is she's applying this theory that the public will react on belief and emotion over fact. So in other words, the facts aren't important. It's the belief and the emotion that you can instill into people, which is where Greta Thunberg comes in.
Yeah.
The little girl with Asperger's who's going to save the planet. You know, it's incredibly well worked out, cynical, but also it's very simple once you really get behind this. But because it's such a big program and it goes into so many areas of people's lives, they think that it can't possibly be connected. And of course it is.
This is right, of course. And we've said it too many times about the ineptitude. It's not ineptitude, of course, it's far more cynical, of the media, because the media isn't in the business of putting this together for people in a way they can understand it. The media basically goes along with it. I mean, there were some very interesting interviews today with people from Greenpeace where the presenters were just going along with it. You know, Greenpeace political, what's the woman's name? Let me get it there. Rebecca Newsom, head of politics at Greenpeace, going on Sky this afternoon, saying we'll have to have an 80% reduction in meat consumption before 2050. People won't be allowed to fly more than once a year, or they will be tax-free once a year, but after that, they'll be taxed very heavily on any subsequent flights and all the rest of it. There isn't any presenters or any reporters saying, well, hang on a second, what are you basing this on? Where are you getting your information from? It's appalling, really. Now, if you had to sum up, if you had to give a definition in two sentences of social engineering in a way that people can understand it, what is social engineering? What does it mean? What is it designed to do?
Well, basically, it's controlling the narrative of public opinion. Let's keep it very simple.
Lovely.
And in order to do that, what you have to do is impose certain things. The climate apocalypse is a huge part of that. And of course, that gets right into the emotions and the beliefs of the people. So they're going to say, of course I want to save the planet. So all you have to do then is give them the instructions on how to do it. And that's right. What I mean by social engineering in this context. The,
yeah.
The actual area of social engineering is a very wide concept. And some of it is not bad or good. You know, some of it is just about the study of how this stuff works in society. And so not all social engineering is bad, but to actually get down to what this really is, the word, the phrase social engineering really does describe it, because that's what it is. You can look at that, just look at the phrase, don't look at any other interpretations. And what does that mean to you? Social engineering. They're engineering society. And of course, this all comes out of people like Huxley and you know, Brave New World, and of course Orwell's 1984. They kind of predicted what was going to happen. But what we're going into with all this social engineering is a new totalitarianism. It's a new system of totalitarianism. So people say it's communism. Well, on one level it is. Agenda 21, which is what all this rationing and stopping people flying and getting people to live in smart cities and taking away their rights of travel, is all about that. Yes. Now, the thing is, if you want to get people to accept these draconian measures, you have to scare them. And that's what this is about. And there's actually not much behind the scare stories. So
this is really important stuff, Mark. This is really important stuff, this. What, just to briefly summarize that, as far as I understand it, the scare stories that work on people's emotion, it works on people's fears, their base fears, not on their ability to discern the facts from the fiction. They lose that ability. They get caught up in the in the fear. They believe that, wow, in 25, 30 years, we won't be able to breathe. The weather events will be horrendous. Then they begin, it's excellently explained by you. I watched your videos. I always watch your videos. And then what happens then is people then begin to go along with their own imprisonment, because what they're talking about, you know, the Internet of Things wired up to every device in your kitchen and in your house, which is basically surveillance. You can't eat more than X amount of pounds of meat in a week. You can't leave the house. You can't do this. You can't put this in your bins. You can't put your bins out. You can't have a car anymore. They said today, no diesel, no petrol cars by 2030. And they want this enshrined in law. And what you're saying, there's nothing brilliant about this, but you're surmising it very, very, very well, is that people won't stop and think, Mark, Jesus, this is madness. How can they do this? People will go, oh, well, it's for the better good. It's for the greater good.
Yeah, I'll give you a good example, Richie. Maybe people can relate to this. There was a thing called Play Streets that came out years ago. It was about, like, let's close the streets off so kids can play in it, just like they did in the 50s, you know. And of course, people remember those Jubilee parties and things that were old people old enough, you know. They remember all these street parties and events with the kids playing out in the streets, in a cobbled street. So that's the image that they put up originally on their website. Now, what that's changed into is a thing called school streets. So now what they're doing is they're closing all the streets off around schools, so the parents can't get anywhere near to take their kids in. And they have armies of people who are basically what we could call sort of green fascists, and that's their terminology, you know, using fascist in the way that they understand it, who are lobbying to stop people driving to school. Now, the way this works is very simple. All this you do is you recruit the people who are what the Soviets used to call useful idiots or change agents, and you give them power in local areas. Now, what happens is that most people in their local area haven't got a clue what's going on. For instance, there's Facebook groups that are set up for this thing called school streets, and nobody in that area, apart from these people who are implementing it on the behalf of the public, will actually know about
right,
it.
Right, right.
So you'll get this. A friend phoned up the other day. He said, I've just moved and all the streets are closed and nobody knows how it happened. Well, we do know how it happened, because there was a consensus that was brought about by basically a fake consultation that nobody knows about, nobody heard of, and it was implemented by just a few people. And that's exactly what happened in the borough I used to live in. I watched that being engineered from a place where you could go anywhere, it was all open, to basically what you could call an open concentration camp. It actually turned into a place that could be shut down by four police cars, and you could probably contain about 200,000 people. Now, people don't think of it in those terms, but the thing is about this agenda, it's about that level of control. So when you apply the word social engineering to that, you're getting close to what it's about. It's about control and management of population and all resources and energy on the planet. And energy is a resource. So all of this stuff is taken into consideration. But these draconian measures that have come in over the past few years could never have been brought in if there had been genuine democratic input locally. It would have taken ages, and of course it didn't. So London's been re-engineered within 3 to 4 years. So how can that happen? And how can these policies be implemented locally, which are global policies? remember. This is going on all over the world. So how can it go from global to local? Well, it goes from global to local through an organization called ICLEI. That's I-C-L-E-I. Now, I can bet that none of your listeners, apart from a very few, will have ever heard of that. None of the public know about it, yet that is how these global decisions from the UN, the Agenda 2030 Sustainable Development Plans, and which came out of Agenda 21, that's how these are implemented locally.
By the way, now, when you came on last, you brilliantly explained this, because I really didn't have much of a grasp of it myself, and you explained it brilliantly. I mean, you really did. You got me thinking about why decentralisation began to happen in my own country, Ireland, in the 1990s. And a light bulb went off over my head when you were talking to me about this, how this works locally, but it's actually a global initiative, a global agenda. And it began to make sense why we had decentralisation from government, you know, and decentralisation of power to local authorities, which sounded like a wonderful thing at the time, but look at what it's done for people in their communities all over the country. It hasn't been good for them that local authorities have been given so much power from government. It's really important that people kind of understand this, Mark. You did explain this terrifically well last time you were on, yeah.
Yeah, they need to understand the sort of people who are being put into local government to make decisions on their behalf. And would they have voted for these people? Now, a lot of these people seem to be parachuted into positions. And I've had interactions with some of them, and I know how they work. They're trained in a certain way. I mean, in 2010, David Cameron announced the Big Society.
Yeah.
And out of that came the idea of social entrepreneurs and community organizers and the Saul Alinsky Rules for Radicals, which were used and openly talked about by people like David Cameron. Now, the Rules for Radicals, you can read on the internet, and they can be used for good or bad. But really, it's about coercion and imposing belief on people. And in order to do that, you have to create what they call a consensus. So we have this artificial consensus, which is exactly the way that groups like Extinction Rebellion work, exactly the way that NGOs who are campaigning for all this stuff, the same thing, which is this control system, that's exactly how they work. They have the same templates, they use the same formulas, and they even use the same phrases like direct action, for instance. You'll see it on these websites when you look at them, all these things that are related or which were part of what Extinction Rebellion came out of, which was a group called Rising Up, and there's a company called Compassionate Revolution Limited. And when you look at the people and who's involved, you realize, wait a minute, these change agents have been around before. For instance, do you remember Democracy Village, Richard? Do you remember that?
Remember the name. I remember you talking about it. I've been watching your videos, of course, yeah.
Yes. Just an example. Maybe I'm going slightly off the subject here, but I hope people understand it, in that there was a campaigner, an anti-war campaigner, who was campaigning against the Iraq war. He's called Brian Hall.
Brian, yeah.
And it was a lady called Barbara Tucker. And they were there for years. And of course, the government wanted them off. So what they did is they brought in a project called Democracy Village. Of course, this is like Brave New World 1984 Clockwork Orange stuff.
It's
all backwards. So there's nothing democratic about it. It was an imposed consensus brought in by trained activists, professional activists, I call them activists, who keep turning up at the same things. And the same ones from Occupy are still around in Extinction Rebellion leading people. And they got on there and they made it impossible for anybody to protest there because so many of them turned up. So if you want people off somewhere like Parliament Square, you can't just ban them from going there because they're going to get annoyed about that and they're going to bring it up in Parliament. So what you do is you create a situation where the public go, oh, we can't have this. This is just, you know, this is undemocratic. There's just people camping there and it's filthy. And so this is the way it works. And the people who were involved in Democracy Village are some of the same people who were involved in Extinction Rebellion. We go into all that at windowsontheworld.net. You can have a look at the articles, but that's briefly sort of how it works. I mean, we're talking about a template here that's rolled out everywhere.
At the same time, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Mark Windows, it's not great stuff. It's great that people can hear this and it's been explained in a way that they understand, because it's true. Check out the articles and the other videos at windowsontheworld.net. That's the website. Mark is, of course, on YouTube as well. I want to mention, and we will get into this, you've got talks coming up, and in 10 days' time, you're in Oxford. That's the 12th of May. And I know there's an Eventbrite page. That's on the homepage, isn't it? Windowsontheworld.net. If you go on the homepage, you can easily get directed from the homepage to the Eventbrite website, where you can get a ticket for it. It's not much more than the price of a couple of drinks, really. And it's terrific. Tell us about that, Mark. Oxford on the 12th of May.
Yes, we're continuing our little tour of The Bigger Picture, which is a series of talks featuring myself, Piers Corbyn and Sandy Adams. And I think Sandy's been on the show
with you. She has. She came on with you. Yeah, really, really interesting lady. Yeah.
Yeah, and what it does is it puts everything into perspective. In other words, how's this stuff that's happening locally tied in to something global? How does that work? Well, that's all explained, and it's all tied together by the belief in man-made climate change. Because without that, the whole thing would fall apart, because people would say, we're not having our roads closed, we're not going to stop traveling, we're not going to stop flying. So the climate change agenda is perfectly described in the talks. And of course, Piers Corbyn goes into that. Sandy Adams goes into the background of Agenda 21, where it came out of the environmental movement, and the very strange kind of belief systems that were involved in it all. And I precede all that with the actual way that all this stuff works generally, and where it came from in a bigger kind of way, you know, in the bigger picture. So when you start putting this all together, and that's what we try and do, is a lot of information to take in. But people walk out and it starts to register. In other words, you will start to see that what's going on locally is exactly the same in your area as it is in every other area.
Down to the last detail. Yeah, down to crossing the T's. Do you know what was that was the fascinating? We had a 90-minute chat a few months ago on a Friday, you and me, and I know Sandy Adams dropped in, and it got me thinking. Actually, when I first met you in London, we were at TPV, we were working one day, and I was chatting with somebody who was producing my program, and we were talking about what you were doing. We were saying Mark is really focused in on, you know, what's happening locally, and I so didn't understand at the time. I had no idea about this, that I thought, why is he doing that? Why is he, you know, so interested in what's happening on a local level in certain parts of this country? You know, it's not going to really mean much to people. You know, how wrong I was, but that's what I thought at the time. And that's what you were breaking through, I think, with people, to get them to understand that this begins locally. It begins and ends locally for everybody, no matter where you are, you know, whether you're in Southampton, whether you're in Manchester or Liverpool. And, you know, I think you're really on the ball here. And what you're saying is, it's mirrored. What you're seeing in Milton Keynes, in your local town, it's identical in Nova Scotia, in some village in California, right? Down to the T's and the I's.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Milton Keynes, because that was kind of part of the Garden Cities project. There was a Garden Cities project. And I found out all about that. And in actual fact, the Garden Cities project was a really good idea. But when you look into what they're doing with Agenda 21, it's kind of the opposite of that. The Garden Cities were actually to make places that were really nice to live. In other words, you'd have lots of cul-de-sacs. And the original idea with Milton Keynes was to have a monorail all the way through it, but that didn't happen. I mean, it's a very, very, very uniform way of making a city. It's pretty boring, really, but in my opinion. But it was kind of practical. But it was at the time when they were producing what they call Garden Cities, which had a lot of green space, and they kept the main roads away from the urban, the developments where people were living. And of course, you had these cul-de-sacs. But Agenda 21 is kind of the opposite of that. It's like the cutting off of everything and putting people into high rises and stack and pack housing, which you can't own. The whole point of this is about the destruction of property rights, and actually the destruction of what we call inalienable rights. So you're right. I mean, it was interesting getting your opinion on that then, because a lot of people didn't understand at that time that these local issues were global.
Yeah, they wouldn't have. No, no.
They call it global local.
Yeah, I wouldn't have had a clue. You see, I always focused on major geopolitical events as a way to try and explain to people, look, let me analyse this geopolitical event in a different way. Let me give you a different take on it. There's nothing wrong with that per se, but it's very difficult to relate to, often, not with everybody, but with many people, it's very difficult to relate that to them locally, especially in this world where people are more and more and more inward looking, and they're more maybe self-obsessed, they're more concerned with themselves in this era of selfish individualism, maybe. It's more difficult to get them to see it. But I think you're really onto something here. By getting people to see what's going on your very street and across the road from your house, that's the way through to people. To then broaden it out to a look at what's happening around the world. This is a global agenda, but you need to see it locally before you can really see it. I suppose the cliche would be, you know, you can't see the wood for the trees. It's happening right in front of your eyes in your local community. It is, Mark. You know, I see it here. Since we had that discussion, I've been looking here in South Manchester at what's going on around this area, the plans for this area. It's amazing we're talking today. It's local election day in England and in Wales and Northern Ireland, I think. You know, incredible. Although there was nobody canvassing in my area, in Fallowfield, I must say that. It's hugely important. Let me just remind our guest, Mark Windows is live on the line. Go to windowsontheworld.net. If you can make the talk on May 12th in Oxford, do. On the homepage, windowsontheworld.net, there's a link to the Eventbrite ticketing site. Buy a ticket, go and educate yourself. Bring somebody with you. Piers Corbyn, who's a friend and colleague of Mark's, works closely with Mark, was on with us last week. Piers will be there, as will be Sandy Adams. Do you think in 2030, if this goes unchallenged, that we won't have the access to our cars that we have enjoyed, I suppose? I mentioned earlier on, I've got a 2013 old, it's not that old, but it's a Renault Megane estate. Funny enough, my annual tax is £5 on it, because it's apparently it's very low emissions, even though it's a diesel. Do you think I won't be able to drive that in 2030 if we don't do something about this, Mark?
Well, if the global action plan has its way, you won't be able to drive it. And let's look at it this way. Let's look at the draconian implementation of this plan. It's done without public consultation, and it's done on the back of something which will turn out to have been the most monstrous lie of the century, I think, even more than 9/11. I know your listeners would be interested in that comparison. That's why I brought it up. But
I think you're right.
The point is, yeah, but I think this is a bigger thing because it affects more people. In other words, it affects people in their daily lives. It restricts everything. And this is the new totalitarianism that they want to bring in. And that's why I find it so fascinating and also so important, because you can attach this to almost everything that's going on because it's all a part of it. But to get back to your question, if people want to do something about it and stop it, it can be stopped, because there has to be an illusion of democracy.
Yeah.
Now, if people realize, and Brexit was a brilliant example of this, that their vote means nothing, which it doesn't. Okay, so that's now becoming more and more obvious to more people. So there is an opportunity for people to start doing something. Now, what I would say is that these plans are absolutely totalitarian, and as the UN says, no one will be left behind.
That's
meaning
right.
That you will not be allowed to be outside this controlled narrative and what's going to happen. However, if the lid comes off the climate change agenda, which is pushing it, they have a major problem, and it has been to a certain extent. We have a big problem in the UK in that people are very influenced by the mainstream media generally, much more influenced than in other countries. And in my opinion, the public in the UK have been more ideologically subverted than in many other countries.
Do you think the Brexit thing has given people a second look, or has given them a reason to look again at the media? You made a brilliant point there about the ignoring of the votes of 17.4 million people. Might that, and especially the way the BBC has conducted itself, and Sky News particularly, do you think people over the Brexit issue might be beginning to realise that the media is not what they thought it was?
That's the impression that I get when I talk to people, because I think that is quite defining. And that can be tied into everything else that's going on. In other words, there's an agenda that's rolling forward very quickly, and you don't have a say in it. And that's really what this is about. It's about taking back local sovereignty and people getting together. However, there is a huge kind of apathy amongst the general public, and that's what this depends on. It depends on public apathy and ignorance, because if people were going into these local council meetings or were able to find out about them, then they would quickly realise that they're being run on by consensus, which means that everyone's there and made to look as though a decision has been made on their behalf, when it, of course it hasn't. So basically you've got your agenda. So you've got your predicted outcome, which is everyone agrees, and you just steer them into it, closing doors along the way. In other words, well, we can't have that. Do you want the red one or the blue one? Oh, well, the red one is on special offer this week. The blue one we won't get for 6 months, etc. It's Delphi technique is just about closing doors and controlling people. And that's what they use, Delphi technique, which is a way of controlling group consensus. And you'll see a facilitator and a co-facilitator. And once you recognize that they're using this technique, it can be usurped. There was a great video someone sent me. It was a country in Scandinavia. I think it may have even been Sweden, a local council meeting. And the people there started asking for a bit of democracy, heaven forbid, you know. And of course, these people were just using their stock phrases to interrupt them and stop them talking, which is what Delphi technique is all about. It's about shutting down opposition. And people went absolutely mad in there, and all the councillors had to leave. They all walked out.
They all went, did they? Marvellous.
Yes. It was a defining moment, because the public in that meeting had realised that the whole thing was a sham and a charade. And these people were hoodwinking them in a really devious and very controlling way. So once the public realised that they don't have any input, then they can actually do quite a lot. I mean, the talks that we've had have been full of people who are very discriminating. I think we get some very interesting people listening to the show, and what they do is they give me information from all over the country. So I do know what's going on everywhere, and it is all the same template. It doesn't matter whether it's in local government or whether it's a local protest group. They are all taken over. And it's kind of amazing that people don't know this, to me, because once you see the template, it's the same template everywhere. Yeah,
there's a part of you admire it on one level, because it's pretty brilliant, isn't it? I mean, you've got to step back and admire these bastards just for a minute, you know. Acknowledge your enemy and say, wow, you know, this is very good stuff, this, as a means to, you know, not underestimating what it is they are and what it is they want to bring in, and do something about it. Do you admire it on some level? You must do. You're a smart guy.
Well, I'm kind of horrified by it, and
of course you would be. Yeah, but at
the time, you know, it's a very mixed bag the way it operates, because I had an interesting conversation once with somebody who was related into the Huxley family, and they said to me, well, what would you do about it? And we had a very long conversation over a weekend. And what I realized is that the main difference between the people who are doing this at the top, social engineers, is that in the main, they're social Darwinists. And they believe in this kind of survival of the fittest strategy. And they apply that to almost everything, which is why, of course, they're trying to get rid of people on disability benefit and all the rest of it. It's not just a financial thing. It's actually a belief. So when you start to look at what it's based on, this stuff, it's actually based on something that doesn't really have much of a premise. In other words, it doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. So what's interesting about it to me, and what I suppose you could admire it, even though I don't, is that they've set up a system which works, which nobody seems to question, which gets them what they want.
That's the admirable bit, by the way. I don't admire it because I, you know, well, obviously we don't agree with it. But you think to yourself, Christ, they're clever. A great friend and colleague of mine often says to me, do you think we'd be good, Richie? You know, if we were in their shoes, do you think we could do it? Because we're reasonably smart. And she thinks, you know, we might be even better than they are. And I'm like, I don't know about that because it's fairly sophisticated. You break it down and you do an amazing job of that. And that's good because people can understand it. But even in your breaking it down, to me, it's still so very sophisticated. Can I ask you this? These social Darwinists, are we seeing the beginnings of, well, maybe it's been there for a long time, but are we seeing an increasing attack now on older people and on older people being useless and worthless and responsible? Go ahead.
Well, you can see that that's being imposed. You can see it in newspapers. You can see it in stories where it's being encouraged to actually not take any notice of older people. Now, having traveled to quite a few countries, this is a really interesting central point, because in most other countries that have a strong cultural identity, which of course is the antithesis of what the global governance template is about, it's about, as we know, creating a monoculture and a kind of interbred race where there aren't any races left and there's no culture left.
Yes.
Which is what the EU is about. It's about a monoculture. It's about imposing a federal kind of huge state which has everything the same. And that's the whole plan of it. And you look at what's happened to London, especially, it's like one big shopping mall now. And this is the central point of it all, that when you go to other countries and they have cultural identity, they have a lot more respect for the older people.
They sure
because
do.
The older people know more about the history. So they go to, I was in Nepal and I went to a city called Bhaktapur and I stayed there for several weeks. Funnily enough, Richie, I met somebody from TPV there who was staying in the same hotel.
Is that right?
Yeah. Some guy said, you're one of the people's boys in TPV.
It's a small world.
That's
then.
Right. So,
it's a small world, yeah.
Yeah, where's a small point being that the older people there are looked after by the younger people. They're happy. They get up, they sing. They have these little events going on all the time and they have their traditional costumes that they dress up in and when they have these festivals, and they have this strong culture which cannot be infiltrated. And when I was over there, the people were extremely aware of the influence of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, which basically form a shadow government within a country, and they were aware of it. Yet here, I don't think people are aware of it because of the way we are, and there's a belief in this country that we're very advanced. It's very interesting, isn't it, that you go to countries where it's deemed to be they're much poorer and it's, oh, they say it's a third world country. But in those countries, there is a strong cultural identity and people can see through pretty much anything, I found. So I think that's the thing that's very important.
What you've just said there is the most important thing that anybody has said on UK media today. I'm not kissing your backside. What you've just said there is vitally... There won't be a more important statement made on any television or radio show tonight in the UK. What Mark has said there is bang on. Anybody who's travelled around the world... We lived in Spain for years. We know how they treat their senior citizens. They revere them. They love them for their knowledge and their experience. We had a little taste of North Africa. The same thing there. I wonder... I think you fit on something really important here. Do you think that amongst our older population, they do understand this on some level? And maybe that's why they're being attacked. Do you think our septuagenarians and octogenarians, you know, people who maybe went through the Second World War, people who saw, you know, the creation of the welfare state, people who remember people like Tony Benn, do you think on some level they understand what's going on? Therefore, they're an enemy that has to be dealt with.
You've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. Because if you want to re-engineer society very quickly, you have to get rid of that generation. Because you educate, we've got two or three generations of people who've been educated into this new system of education. And also, we've got to remember that the principles of secondary education, it was a book that came out in 1918, which was that the idea of school was secondary education was to prevent change. So the thing is that we've all been brainwashed and programmed to a certain degree. However, when you have experience of
a time period,
then you've seen, as you say, First and Second World Wars, and you start to see a pattern. And older people do have that knowledge. I'm not generalizing here, but it's inbuilt into experience.
So you
have to get rid of that, because if you look at the people who are following this, say, Extinction Rebellion, well, I know that that's a template copy of what happened with Occupy when George Soros invested a lot of money to turn it into climate change. And the use of General Assembly, people asking for citizens' assemblies basically to go against what's called democracy is absolutely absurd. It's totalitarian. But you can't bring in this agenda with people who have got any life experience or any knowledge. It won't work.
No, because for them, the red flags will go up and they'll want to talk about it. Because we have seen it in news stories, as you said, you're absolutely right, in recent weeks. But even government proposals and that committee set up that's looking at the unfairness and the inequality and, you know, how we need to remove the triple lock on pensions and make the financial future for older people who've worked all their lives and paid into the system, make it less stable and less safe because, well, we've got to think of the young people as well. And, you know, on one basic level, you can call it divide and conquer, but I think you've absolutely nailed it. It's far more sinister than that. We have to eliminate a generation of people who are a bit more savvy, a bit more street smart, and who might understand what it is that's happening. It's coming up for 20 minutes past the hour. We're going to go for another 5 or 6 minutes, Mark, till just before 6:30. WindowsOnTheWorld.net is Mark's website. You can find out a lot more there. I think you're terrific, Mark, to be honest. You know, in an independent media that's increasingly becoming more and more narcissistic and about who can shout the loudest and, you know, people out to make a quick buck for themselves by selling people back things that they already know, telling people what they want to hear. It's unbelievably refreshing what you've been doing. You do your research. It's tough. It's hard. It's labour intensive. It's time consuming to put all this stuff together forensically the way you do. And you upload it daily and weekly on WindowsOnTheWorld.net and on your YouTube channel. I think it's brilliant, mate. We're all the better for having you. I do really mean that. WindowsOnTheWorld.net. In the last few minutes we have then, and by the way, go to WindowsOnTheWorld.net if you can make the event in Oxford on May the 12th, right? That's May 12th. It's only 10 days away.
We've got another one coming up, Richie, on the 1st of June in Glastonbury.
Oh, in Glastonbury.
1st of June in Glastonbury.
Fantastic. Yes. Brilliant, mate. It won't be your first time organising an event in Glastonbury. You did something there last year, didn't you? If I remember.
That's right. Yes, it will be at the King Arthur in Glastonbury. And there's a lot more people down there switched on to what's going on through the 5G agenda and the smart cities now. So they're getting more interested in that. One thing I'd just like to say to anybody who's involved in any of these protests, and you've probably got a very worthy reason to be there, the globalists need the anti-globalists to bring in their agendas. And what people within Extinction Rebellion are doing are bringing in the Global Action Plan, and they are bringing in the agenda of the globalists. So in other words, the whole thing is part of the plan, and we wouldn't be seeing Sadiq Khan and Jeremy Corbyn declaring climate emergencies and all the rest of it if these were a real protest group, because they're not. They're a socially engineered concept to bring in totalitarianism. And that's what it's about.
What do you think yourself in the last 2 minutes we have today? Thanks for coming back on, by the way. You're welcome back anytime, Mark. What's your gut feeling? Do you think maybe because of Brexit, maybe because of things becoming harder financially for people, maybe because people are seeing through the behaviour of the press and the media, do you think in time to stop it, do you think we'll get to a place where we'll be able to stop this happening? What's your gut feeling on it?
Well, it's such a difficult question, but I would say that there is a chance to roll a lot of it back. And there is major flaw. There's a major flaw in the concepts that are being brought in that they are template. They're all the same. And once you see through this template, it's busted. Once you see through a template that's implemented from local areas to global, then it's not a working formula anymore. So that formula can be broken very easily.
There's no denying it, basically. Once you can see it, there's no denying it. You can't ignore it.
No, and it's about people realizing that they do have inalienable rights. Inalienable rights have been taken away, and that means rights which cannot be leaned. A lien is basically putting a charge or a debt onto somebody, and your inalienable rights cannot be leaned, and you do have them. And I'm working on an audiobook at the moment which explains it all. I've done about 25 years of research altogether into this stuff. So I'm trying to put it into a series of books, audiobooks, and it'll be available on the website. The reason I'm saying that is not to plug them, but just to basically give people an idea that this stuff can be rolled back. And it's down to the individual to actually take action. You see, the whole of this works on collectivism, people with a hive mind. And you only need to get certain people who are trained and then get the others into the hive mind. And then you've got your consensus, haven't you? That people repeat, like 97% of scientists agree that we're heading for a global catastrophe. They all repeat it without any foundation evidence. So if you take responsibility for your own actions, then that was a very important first step. And the people who do that and live by honor and truth do often succeed. And history does reveal that.
Going to be an interesting ride between now and, I reckon, between now and 2022, you know, even before we get to 2030 and diesel and petrol cars. Mark will be speaking in Oxford in 10 days' time with Sandy Adams and Piers Corbyn. Eventbrite.com, but there's a direct link on the homepage, windowsontheworld.net. And in June, he's in Glastonbury. He was there last year, and that was a big success. Go and check it out and bring somebody with you who's never heard of any of this. I'd be very excited about doing that. You know, the next time you're in this neck of the woods, I'm going to do that. I'm going to come to see you and Piers and Sandy, and I'm going to bring a couple of people that have never heard of any of it. That's the thing to do. All the power in the world to you and what you're doing, mate. I appreciate you coming back on the programme. You know you're welcome back anytime, Mark. Have a good bank holiday weekend, mate, and great success to you and the rest of the gang in Oxford in 10 days' time.
Thanks, Richie. That was really good. Thanks a lot for your time. Cheers.
You're welcome, mate. Mark Windows there. The website, Mark Windows' website, is windowsontheworld.net. Check it out. Bookmark it. Great guy. And the stuff he's doing with Piers Corbyn and Sandy Adams, I think, is vital. I really do. Check it out. Right, that's about it for the programme. It's about it for this week's programmes, in fact. Thanks to all my guests this week. Thanks so much to you for listening. The programme, I'll be back with you on Sunday morning, of course, at 11 a.m. UK time with Sunday View. I know one or two of you have been saying, oh, are you gone now till Tuesday? No, I'm not. This coming Monday is a bank holiday. I will not be working on bank holiday Monday, but I will, of course, be working on Sunday, because Sunday isn't a holiday. The bank holiday Sunday, or the Sunday holiday, was Easter Sunday. I will be with you this coming Sunday at 11 a.m. UK time with Sunday View, and I look forward to that. In the meantime, have a terrific weekend. I think we're in for some bad weather. I think we're in for some bad weather this coming weekend. It's going to be cold and wet and miserable, but anyway, you can't have it all your own way. We had a terrific bank holiday weekend, weather-wise, didn't we, 2 weeks ago. Leaving you with some Lenny Kravitz. Have a great weekend. And we'll speak Sunday. Alrighty, bye for now. Thanks again to Mark Windows.